With more people staying at home amid the coronavirus pandemic, calls to child abuse hotlines are down. But advocates say that is not a good sign. Meanwhile, across the country and here in Illinois, African Americans are dying from COVID-19 at a much higher rate than other groups.
This is something that is a public health red alarm that we have to make sure that we are stepping up as a community to address it.
We'll talk about the disproportionate health and economic effects of the disease on Black communities. And with Passover beginning tonight and Easter this weekend, we'll talk with a rabbi and a priest about keeping the faith in a time of crisis. All that coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. First, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Wednesday morning, Illinois has had more than 13,500 confirmed cases of coronavirus disease. The most recent announcement from the Illinois Department of Public Health came on Tuesday afternoon, and it also included the highest one-day total of 73 additional deaths, bringing the state's total of COVID-19 fatalities to 380. A disproportionate share of those deaths are among people of African American descent. We'll talk more about why the coronavirus pandemic is taking a greater toll on that community later this hour. And this week, for Jews and many Christians, it's among the holiest times of the year. We'll also talk about making Passover or marking Passover and Easter at a time of social distancing. But first, as Illinoisans continue to be under a stay-at-home order to stop the spread of the virus, for some young people, home isn't always the safest place. Calls to the Illinois Child Abuse Hotline have declined by about half since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. That may sound like a good thing, but advocates say it is not that child abuse is decreasing, but it's more likely that kids are not interacting with people like teachers or counselors who are required to report abuse and neglect when they see it. Dua Eldeeb is a journalist at ProPublica Illinois and reported on the story. Dua, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Also joining us is Denise McCaffrey, Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Illinois. Denise, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Do I want to begin with you? You reported a story for ProPublica Illinois about how calls to the DCFS child abuse hotline actually decreased by about half. When did they start going down?
Pretty much immediately. So if you look at the week-by-week numbers, the week before schools shut down and kids were not being seen by their teachers and counselors, DCFS had received more than 6,000 calls to the hotline to report allegations of abuse and neglect. That next week, were closed on that Tuesday. That week, the numbers went down by 45% to a little over 3,000.
And we might, as I said, we might think that calls going down is a good thing, but that seems not to be the case. Can you explain to us why that is?
Sure. Yeah. So I talked to, a number of experts and people who work with children, and they're saying their greatest concern is it's really because children are out of the public eye. And so many of the calls that they normally get are from counselors and social workers and doctors and nurses. And now because children aren't in front of those same people, they're not getting the same amount of calls. And, DCFS is saying we know that the rate of abuse and neglect hasn't gone down. It's just the reporting. And that's what has everyone so concerned.
And I think you kind of got at this in what you said there, but can you just help us understand who exactly are mandatory reporters? What does that mean?
Sure. So the law requires mandated reporters to notify DCFS if they have what's known as a reasonable cause to believe that a child is being abused or neglected. And so mandated reporters are people who interact with children in a professional or official capacity. So think of, you know, like we said, doctors, nurses, dentists, you know, counselors, police, clergy, daycare providers. And so if any of them, you know, during their interactions with a child has, you know, reason to believe that a child is being abused or neglected, by law, they have to report that to DCFS. And then DCFS will determine, you know, if that information is enough to trigger an invitation, investigation.
Okay. And we're also joined by Denise McCaffrey, Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse, Illinois. And Denise, I want to ask you, has your agency been discussing a similar drop in reporting since kids have been told to stay home from school?
Absolutely. And this is not unique to Illinois. We are part of a larger national network, and we're seeing this trend across all of the states in the U.S.
And can you put a number on it? How does this, you know, how does this number manifest itself? Is it a drop of half or a smaller percentage, a bigger percentage?
It varies across the states, but as you were saying here in Illinois, it is about half. And it is very concerning because we know that, you know, families are under a lot of stress now that we're sheltering in place. And kids are under stress too. You know, we forget that they aren't seeing their friends. They aren't, you know, keeping up with their normal routines. Even small children and infants can sense the increased stress in parents. So that affects their behavior. They might be acting out. They might be more clingy, but that adds to a parent's stress. So we're very worried about the kids that are home.
So who, and we just heard about mandated reporters from Duo, but who are those the people who call these hotlines most often?
Yes, the largest percentage of calls to the hotline do come from mandated reporters.
Okay, do I want to ask you, what did you hear from mandated reporters, teachers, school counselors when you were reporting on your story?
So they're worried. You know, I talked to, you know, a teacher and a counselor that I, you know, quoted in the story, and basically they're saying, you know, they had children that, you know, before this happened that they were worried about, but they would be able to check in with them during the school day. And now their only way to really check on them is through, you know, official school emails. And so they've reached out to them. They're doing their best that they can, but they're, you know, they're limited in how much they can actually reach out to these kids. And so they're really worried as well.
And I understand that one social worker in Chicago told you that school workers are kind of the agency's eyes and ears. Are you hearing anything in particular from social workers?
So social workers are, you know, represent a big portion of the people who are reporting, and these are social workers at schools or at hospitals. And so, again, I think that, you know, the theme from every person is really the same. We're worried. And, you know, they... What I've heard from DCFS is, you know, in April, they're starting to see an even more severe or steep drop in the numbers. And while they see this kind of a similar pattern during the summer, you know, when kids are out of school, the concern is now because of the added pressure, the economic pressure, the, you know, kind of mental and physical pressure at home, being at home, especially people are losing their jobs. They're worried that that could even exacerbate things more.
And Dua, you heard from a Chicago children's advocate that specifically economic stress, which obviously a lot of people are feeling right now, record unemployment claims in Illinois and across the country. But you heard that economic stress can really, you know, increase rates of child abuse in particular.
Absolutely. So, you know, this is something that you see, for example, in times of recession. And so you're seeing it again now. And, you know, when families are worried about putting food on the table, when families are, you know, having to choose between going to work or feeling like they're getting, you know, they're putting their health at risk or the health of their families at risk, it really increases the level of stress, the level of just kind of frustration at home, which, you know, even for the most well-intended parents can really blow up at the worst times.
Denise, you mentioned family stress and, you know, stress among children, stress among parents. But there's another situation where if parents do have to work in jobs where they can't stay at home and kids aren't in school, they may be with an alternate caregiver. And that can be concerning too, right, Denise?
Oh, absolutely. That is a big concern of ours because we do have parents that are still working and they might be leaving their children with caregivers that they don't know very well or caregivers that are inexperienced. They may be leaving kids with older siblings that are inexperienced and may pose a threat to the children. Oftentimes we see that pedophiles who might be wanting to do some harm to a child through child sexual abuse will be the first to offer to babysit for that child. So we really urge parents to be careful who they're leaving their kids with. And there's things they can do to check in with their kids. How did it go today? How do you feel staying with this person? Tell me what you guys did today. So there's things parents can do to safeguard against this, but we're really worried about who the kids are staying with right now.
So let's talk about that, Denise. What is your agency doing to try and address this? I mean, without having mandatory reporters, what do you hope people will do?
Well, we really, we're like everyone else. We're on social media. We're trying to get the word out to parents. And we're really encouraging everyone to reach out to family, friends, and neighbors that they know of that have kids. Check in with them. Ask them how they're doing. See if you can help in any way. So we are really encouraging people to be in contact, watch out for those kids, and really help parents as well. See if you can reduce some of the stress they're under.
And I don't know if you can give sort of, obviously mandated reporters go through a lot of training, I would imagine, but for the everyday person, what are some things that people should be looking out for? What are some signs that there might be a problem?
Signs and symptoms of child abuse and neglect are always really hard. If there's physical abuse, you will probably see some physical signs, some bruising, some marks on the children that don't match the child's story. Maybe they have bruising on multiple spots on their body. Those are the easy things to look for. A lot of child abuse and neglect have no signs, and you'll, have to really pay attention to the child's behavior. Are they acting differently than they did before? Are they shying away? Is the parent keeping the child isolated? Maybe you can't see the child. You want to FaceTime and they say, oh no, they're asleep right now, and they won't let you see the child. Pay attention to little things that are red flags that make you worry about that child's safety.
And Denise, what if a parent is feeling particularly stressed right now? What should they do?
Well, parenting is the hardest job we'll ever do, no matter what. Just being a caregiver for a child is hard work, and it is stressful on a day-to-day basis. And right now, we are all under so much more stress than we were. And I think that parents need to, if you're feeling stressed, reach out for help. It's hard to do. It's hard to ask someone for help, but it's important. If you really feel that you are in danger or you have hurt your child, call the child abuse hotline. If you feel you just need to talk to someone, talk through some different parenting techniques, things you can do, there are helplines out there that parents can reach out to.
And do it. What are you hearing from the state, from DCFS, the Department of Children and Family Services, about how they are going to address this problem as the people that they normally count on, the mandated reporters, have gone down and have lost contact with a lot of the kids?
So what they're saying is right now more than ever, they're really relying on family members and neighbors and close friends to report any suspicion to the hotline. One of the things that really stood out to me was this idea that, don't assume somebody else will report it. You have a suspicion, but you think, oh, maybe it's not exactly what I think it is, or maybe somebody else will report it. They're saying, really, you might be the only person to see it, so report it. And it's not, it's not just because you report it doesn't mean that automatically, they'll investigate. They have their criteria, so don't worry about kind of over-reporting at this point.
And Denise, I wonder, based on what Dua just said there, I got to imagine there's a huge sort of internal pressure. People feel like, oh gosh, I really don't want to bring this on that family. Maybe, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing. How do you navigate that? How do you overcome that? What I would imagine is intense pressure to not report, unless there's, obviously clear and convincing evidence that there's something wrong. But if you just have a suspicion, how do you deal with that?
Right. Well, you know, we use the taglines that all children deserve great childhoods, and we all have a role to play in keeping children safe. And I think that you have to err on the side of the child. You might be that child's only lifeline. You really might be. And, you know, it is important to make that call. You don't have to have proof. You just have to suspect. And we're always telling people that err on that side of the child, keep them safe.
Only about a minute left, but Denise, this is Child Abuse Awareness Month, April is. How is this different this year?
Well, it's different because we're not able to be out in large gatherings, doing trainings, pulling people together, holding rallies or kickoff events. And so we are really relying on getting the word out through emails, social media, word of mouth, planting pinwheel gardens, tying blue ribbons. We're really encouraging everyone to do what I mentioned earlier, check on your family, your friends, and your neighbors. Really reach out, offer support to families and people that are home with their kids that might be experiencing stress.
Okay. Denise McCaffrey is the Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Illinois. We also spoke with Dua Eldeeb, who's a reporter with ProPublica Illinois. She's been talking with us. They've both been talking with us about a decline in calls to the DCFS Child Abuse Hotline, which advocates worry is a sign that it is not being reported, not that child abuse is actually decreasing. Denise, Dua, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And if you suspect child abuse or you feel that a child is being neglected or is at risk, please do call the Illinois Child Abuse Hotline. The number is 800-25-ABUSE. That's 800-252-2873. 25-ABUSE. And we want to remind you that every Thursday on the 21st, we're going to be having a different conversation about mental health amid the coronavirus pandemic. Tomorrow, we're going to be hearing from people going through recovery and speak with addiction experts. If you would like to share your experience or you have any questions about it, you can always record a voice memo on your phone. Send it to us at talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Or you can tweet us at 21stshow to join the conversation. You're listening to The 21st. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. You're tuned in to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The novel coronavirus is killing Black Chicagoans at a disproportionately high rate. That's according to an analysis by WBEZ and data from the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office and the Chicago Department of Public Health. Even though African Americans make up less than 30% of Cook County's population, more than half of all COVID-19 cases in the county are among Black residents. On Monday, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot addressed these numbers at her daily press conference.
This is not just about racial and ethnic disparities in the outcomes. The distribution of this disease tells a story about resources and inequality. A story about unequal health care access, job access, and community investment. Dynamics we know all too well here in the city of Chicago, and something that all of us have been talking about and fighting against for years.
For more on this, we're joined now on the line by Natalie Moore. She's a reporter on WBEZ's Race, Class, and Communities desk. Also with us is Greg Kelly, president of the Service Employees International Union Healthcare of Illinois and Indiana. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Natalie, I want to begin with you. As the coronavirus has continued to spread, the rhetoric around the virus is often that it's a great equalizer, that anyone could get it, anyone could get sick from it. But what we're seeing here with these numbers suggests that, no, all things are not equal, right?
Right. I mean, anyone can get coronavirus. That is true. But it's structural racism and inequalities that make the differences so stark right now. So there's nothing biological. There's nothing about skin color or biology that is making the numbers the way they are. It's about the structures that we have in our society.
And can you talk about what some of those structures are?
Yeah, access to healthcare, access to neighborhoods with grocery stores, underlying health conditions. You know, if you look at the elements that are stacked against Black people in Black neighborhoods, you know, everything from housing discrimination to grocery store discrimination to healthcare, you know, there's a pattern of inequality. And so it's going to play itself out in this as well. You know, I didn't expect this to be any different.
And I think we've seen that with COVID-19, if you have certain underlying health conditions like respiratory problems or diabetes, that makes one more susceptible to this illness, I think. Can you talk a little bit more about some of those chronic health conditions that members in the Black community have had to face and how that's playing
right
into what we've been seeing?
It's just what you said. So the underlying health conditions, the hypertension, the diabetes, and all of those things are not just because people ate something bad. There's stress in these communities and the lack of health care in some of these communities. So all of this gets really compounded.
Greg Kelly with Service Employees International Union Healthcare. I want to bring you into this conversation. Can you follow up on that? Were you surprised by these statistics?
Well, not at all. Unfortunately, we expected it. I mean, obviously, you don't know what the numbers will ultimately turn out. But our members who live, you know, predominantly on the South and West sides, largely Black workers, but also a fair amount of brown workers as well, work on the front lines. They're lower paid workers in home care, nursing homes and hospitals, and their health outcomes just in general have been disparate or inequitable. And so the work that they do every day, you can see the impact of that inequity. And so we weren't surprised by it. We're obviously devastated by it, because we think that it could still get worse. Our members are working on the front line. They're the nursing assistants, right? They're the home care aide. And they see firsthand, right? They are the front line in this moment. And so it is a devastating indictment of our system, but we're continuing to live even through it now.
You know, I heard it said recently that, Greg, that social distancing, which we're all being advised to do by the government to the extent we can, but that social distancing is a privilege. And I wonder, how does that fit in with the workers that your union represents?
That is absolutely true, whether it's needing to take public transportation just to get to work. You are forced into spaces that don't allow you to socially distance yourself just to get to work. And then when you get to work, you're very often not provided the type of equipment necessary to take care of yourself. They're very low paid, and so they have restrictions in terms of even where they can live. And often you'll find folks have to work 2-3 jobs, thereby putting themselves and other people, by the way, at more consistent risk. And so we have a real problem in our society. And this is bringing it more to the fore than folks have been able to see in the past, I think.
Yeah, and as we're talking about this, we're talking about sort of two different effects. There's the health effects and the disproportionate effect there, but then also the economic effects. And Natalie, in some of your reporting on this, you looked at the 2018 census figures on Chicago, I think, and found that, 68% of bus drivers are Black, 48% of food service workers are Latino, 70% of childcare workers are Black or Latino. When we're talking about 78, thank you.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about Working from home, maintaining social distancing, these are not the kind of careers that have that flexibility, unlike, you know, me, who can do this radio segment from home. How might we continue to see the racial wealth gap grow as this situation continues?
It's going to grow. So even before the numbers came out on the COVID deaths, I was working on this story about who gets to work from home. I'm in a privileged situation, too, where we can set up, you know, with technology to do radio. But the folks who are in the grocery stores, the folks who are cooking our food so we can keep the restaurants afloat, taking care of our children, driving the buses, these frontline workers who aren't first responders in the healthcare sense, I had a feeling that these were going to be black and brown folks, and the numbers panned out for that. And this is not unique to Chicago, whether we're talking about healthcare disparities, the COVID deaths on racial breakdowns, or who gets to work from home. Higher wage workers are more likely to be able to telework, and they're also more likely to be white.
Natalie, you spoke with some of the people who are, we've been talking about people who have to go to work, who can't social distance or work from home. But then there are the people who can't go to work and because they've been laid off, right? And you spoke with some of the people who are out of work right now, including April Grant. And let's listen to what she told you.
My anxiety level is went up. Whatever money I do have saved up, I'm kind of going through it with day-to-day expenses as far as utilities that's coming up, food supply. They do just see us as, oh, you're just the bartender. We're not just only bartenders. You know, we're a lot more than that. We are a part of the working force.
So, Natalie, what else did you hear from workers you spoke with for your story?
A sense of frustration, a sense that they did have some savings to get them through April, but then what would happen next? Another man I talked to who works in the fast food industry as well as a higher-end restaurant, that restaurant is closed, but the fast food chain has cut back his hours. And he was like, I've done everything I'm supposed to do, and I just feel like I'm not being taken care of. We also know that, you know, most Americans don't have large cash reserves. And so when you start talking about folks who work on tips or low-wage workers, that's going to look worse.
Yeah, and Natalie, you spoke with Derek Hamilton, an economist at The Ohio State University, who worked on a study about how policies have left communities of color disproportionately uninsured with fewer financial resources. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so he did as you said, a study about this and was linking it to how this was going to amplify, or not amplify, but it's going to contribute to the existing wealth gap that was already there, the persistent racial wealth gap, and how that's really going to hit Black, Latinx, and Native communities hard. And his study showed that 30% of Black college-educated households and 20% of Latino college-educated households would not be able to afford to pay all their bills after a $400 emergency expense. Again, those are college-educated. And then for non-college-educated, those figures look worse.
Yeah. Greg, I want to ask you, we've been talking mostly about deaths among African Americans. I also wonder if Latino deaths are higher than their share of the population would suggest.
Well, what we've seen in Chicago that, all deaths, I think, are disproportionate and troubling. I just think what we have seen that Black Americans or African Americans have been disproportionately impacted in a greater sense. And I think as we look at the moment that we're in, it's important to reflect on the fact that these things are a result of intentional policies that we've created, whether it's lack of affordable housing, whether it's lack of access to healthcare, whether it's paying a decent wage. These are all decisions that as a society we've allowed to exist for a very long time. And so, you know, the issue won't be resolved quickly, but it's important to hopefully take this moment as an opportunity to say that we have to have different priorities as a society and has a more inclusive outlook, because we don't know how our decisions today could impact us all in the future.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm wondering, you know, these are structural problems that have been built up arguably over centuries, and it's, you know, no, even a $2 trillion stimulus bill cannot fix these things overnight. What are there things, though, that you think government should be doing, either state government, city government, or national government should be doing to try and address these problems in the short term?
Yes, for workers themselves, paid time off, decent wages that allow folks to survive and not have to sometimes work two and three jobs. Some equity with respect to housing, from my perspective, really is critical in this moment in a city like Chicago, where rents are continuing to skyrocket. There are some, you know, policy decisions that we can make that will hopefully in the future reduce these types of outcomes.
And Natalie, I wondered if the economist you spoke with at Ohio State, Derek Hamilton, did he have any sort of short-term policy recommendations?
Well, making sure everyone has health insurance. Mm-hmm. that's a big one. But I also want to point out that there is a local group here, and Greg is probably involved with it, the Right to Recovery memo, where they're laying out all the things that they want, you know, on a local level, state level, and federal. As far as Derek Hamilton from the Ohio State, he talked about moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures. We've seen some of that, but it's not exactly comprehensive. It depends on what kind of loan you have, and the evictions, you know, are dated. And also he talked about comprehensive action to reduce student debt.
Hmm. Greg, can you tell us more about this? What was it, the Right to Recover memo?
Yes, Right to Recovery, a number of groups, in addition to a number of elected officials. It's a vast number of things, but it's around emergency leave guaranteed by the city, county, and the state, an indefinite moratorium on evictions, and pause on all court hearings and filings for evictions and foreclosures, a binding moratorium on water and electricity shutoffs, then a waiver on all late fees and payments associated with such services. We've got a whole list of things, but those are kind of the broad things that have to do with housing, education, that really in this moment, and healthcare, that can really help make the difference in Illinois.
Yeah. And Greg, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but what about long-term solutions? I mean, like we've said, this is a problem that has been with us for a very long time. What sort of things would you like to see to try and address these problems over the long term? We don't know how long we're going to be dealing with this pandemic.
Right. Yeah, I think, again, Natalie nailed it. I mean, for us as a healthcare union, the right to free healthcare, and that access has to be granted to everyone. I think, again, housing policies that reflect the changing nature of a town or a city or the state is necessary. Fair and decent wages so that people don't have to work two and three jobs. Those are just some of the broad brush of things that I would want, or I think are necessary in this moment as a society to move forward.
Greg Kelly is the president of the Service Employees International Union Healthcare, SEIU Healthcare of Illinois in Indiana. We've also been speaking with Natalie Moore. She's a reporter on WBEZ's Race, Class, and Communities desk. Greg and Natalie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And a reminder, every Thursday on the 21st, we're going to be having a different discussion, different conversation about mental health amid the COVID-19 global pandemic. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with people going through addiction recovery and speak with experts on addiction. If you'd like to share your experience, we'd love to hear your story. Or if you have any questions, please record a voice memo on your phone. You can send it to us at talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Tweet us at 21stshow. Join the conversation. Coming up after the break, one of the most celebrated Jewish holidays, Passover, begins today at sundown, and for many Christians, this Sunday is Easter. We're going to be talking with a rabbi and a priest about keeping the faith in a time of pandemic. That's coming up after the break on the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. One of the most celebrated holidays on the Jewish calendar is Passover. It begins this evening at sundown. And for many Christians, this is Holy Week. Sunday is Easter. But in a time when families and congregations usually hope to be together, that is not an option this year because of the stay-at-home order here in Illinois on account of COVID-19. We wanted to speak with two faith leaders about how they've adjusted to this unprecedented situation and how their Passover and Easter messages might be different this week. Rabbi Bina Wing joins us from Temple Beth El in Rockford. Also joining us is the Reverend Jeff Grant, Father Jeff, of Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church here in Springfield, where I am. He goes by Father Jeff. Father Jeff, Rabbi Wing, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Rabbi Wing, I want to begin with you. How do you traditionally celebrate Passover at your temple in Rockford?
So it's one of two ways. Passover is usually one of the holidays that's mainly celebrated in the home. So there are some holidays, like our fall high holidays, that are the holidays where everyone comes to temple. Passover is one where almost everybody celebrates it at home. That being said, my temple on the second night of Passover always has a congregational Seder, number one, for people who may not have a Seder on their own for the first night, but also because we think of our temple members as a kind of family, and so we like to gather together as a temple family as well. So we have a congregational Seder here at temple.
As I understand it, one of the questions that's asked at Passover is why is this night different from all other nights? And so I guess my question to you is, how is this Passover different from all other Passovers?
Well, I mean, one of the main ways that it's different is that one of the main things that happens is people gather together, often in large groups. Families come together around the table. Sometimes families travel from other places to be together. It's often, a large moment of gathering, and in this case, we can't gather physically together, so a lot of people are gathering online.
And Father Jeff, I want to bring you into the conversation. How has Blessed Sacrament changed its services?
Well, this year, all our services will be online. There will not be the gathering. We really start, the big celebrations start on Holy Thursday evening, and then on Good Friday, and then on Holy Saturday is when we have baptisms for those that are coming into the church, and we welcome those that are coming in that are baptized in other faiths that are joining the Catholic Church. And so this year, that will not take place. Everything will be online, and those baptisms and things like that will have to wait until we're able to do that.
And this is, you have been sort of doing or celebrating the Mass, I should say, for mostly empty church buildings, but still broadcasting this for some time now.
We've been doing it since not a whole long time, but about 4 weeks now, since the stay-at-home, since the gathering was reduced to a very small number, and we just couldn't do that, and we felt that it was best not to be in big groups or to be in any groups, really, and so we've been doing it online since, I think last Sunday was the third Sunday we had done it. So this is all new to me, but I'm learning what to do.
And I wonder, what effect has this had on attendance at Mass?
Well, online, I think people may enjoy it a little bit more. I don't know. Our number of the hits that we get online are a little higher than what we would have at Mass attendance if we had it, which kind of surprised me at first. But it might be because several of the parishes do not have Mass. And, you know, sometimes people are looking for a particular thing, and maybe if they had connections here, that's what they did.
And Rabbi Wing, I want to ask you as well, how have services changed in this time of prohibited gatherings?
Right. So our Friday night services, which is the main time when we have our Shabbat services, our Sabbath services, we've been online also for about 3 weeks now. We've been using Zoom for our services, and because, you know, we're not gathering in person either. I think the service even that we had before that, we were already practicing social distancing, and we had asked everyone to sit very far apart, and then we realized after that we just couldn't have people coming in. What's been kind of along the lines of what Father Jeff was saying, our attendance on the virtual services has been tremendous. We've had lots and lots of people signing into the service who might normally not come to services, but it seems that everybody's really craving the togetherness, craving being able to see each other's faces. And we also have people who live in other places, who have moved to other places but still feel connected, who have been tuning into our virtual online Shabbat services. So that's been really great. In fact, one of the people on the service this past Friday suggested that maybe even once things are, you know, back to normal, whatever that looks like, that maybe we would continue once a month to do a Zoom service.
Does that surprise you that people seem to be more engaged with this?
It did kind of surprise me, but it made me aware of, you know, how much we're all just longing to be with each other and to see each other's faces, and I think the other thing too that I've talked about a number of different times already with my congregation is how much we need the Sabbath in, you know, when the days are sort of all running together, and there's in some ways kind of moments where we feel like couch potatoes, and then other moments where we sort of feel frantic with, you know, getting school assignments done and trying to work from home and all of that, that the idea of pausing for a moment and celebrating, stopping and breathing and holiness and joy, that becomes so much more important.
Yeah. Father Jeff, I want to ask you, I think Catholics are part of one of the traditions is to give something up for Lent. And this is not my line. I saw it on Twitter, but somebody was joking that they weren't expecting to give up quite this much for Lent this year.
They weren't expected to give up this much.
Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, one of the hard things I think for a lot of Catholics, a lot of my parishioners, has been that they can't take communion by host. We've actually been asking them to do a spiritual communion, you know, so that they don't spread, the germ the virus or anything like that. And I think that has been a very difficult thing for many people. In fact, you know, they will be happy when we can get back to that, where the Mass online can certainly nourish, it's not the same thing as gathering. It is simply, as the rabbi said, you know, what's important is the gathering of the community. And we're really not able to do that right now. And so they've had to give up that. They've had to give up, you know, things along that line, things like receiving the Eucharist and going through those motions too. They don't have to give up their prayer. They don't have to give up their connections with other people. You know, you can call, you can talk to them, but it's the coming together to worship and to pray together.
Rabbi Wing, I understand at the end of every Seder, it's traditional to say, next year in Jerusalem. This year, I understand you might modify that a little bit. Can you talk about that?
Right. So we traditionally imagine, you know, next year, we say next year in Jerusalem, not just, you know, oh, let's go on a trip, but we sort of imagine it as, you know, next year, may everyone be free. Next year may it be a time where everyone has been redeemed from oppression. So it sort of has a messianic feel to it. But this year, some people want to add in next year in person.
And I guess the hope is that we'll have this behind us and you can have returned to a more traditional Seder next year.
Right, where we can gather together and you know, see each other's faces and talk. And yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's hard too is that technology is sort of an imperfect medium. So, you know, even if you're having a small conversation, normally when you're talking, there's, you know, pretty quick back and forth between one person or another. And you can even, like, in some ways hear more than one person talking at the same time. But with Zoom and, you know, the technology that's out there, really has to be much more purposeful, with sort of one person talking and another person listening. And, you know, so it doesn't have the same kind of ease as in-person conversation.
Yeah. Father Jeff, I want to ask if you've given any thought to your Easter homily coming up for this Sunday and how, in just a couple of minutes we have remaining, how that might change based on the current situation we're in.
Well, I think one thing, we can talk a little bit about the difference between isolation and being together, and that, you know, faith draws us together. What gives us life, and what are the things that are important in that? And, you know, if we experience, you know, if you consider Lent to be kind of a season that's very solemn and, you know, you're focusing on these things and then all of a sudden you celebrate life, you know, how are we going to do that this year when we're still sheltered in place? How are we going to still, can we do that? You know, and do we have to wait till it's over to really experience that? Or can we experience it in this time and age right now?
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm going to try and focus a little bit on. I haven't got it all on paper yet. I've still got Thursday and Friday to do first.
Sure thing. Yeah. And Rabbi Wing, a similar question for you. Is the way you're telling the story of Passover, which of course begins this evening, is the way you're telling the story of Passover changing with the circumstances this year? And again, and just about a minute left.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll focus on what does it mean to, what does liberation mean? What does freedom mean? And there's many ways in which we sort of feel like we're not free, but when we really think about it, we really have quite a bit of freedom. And we'll still raise consciousness for those who are oppressed and have yet to be free. And so in some ways, the message will be the same. But of course, you know, one of the steps of the Seder is to wash your hands. And so we may, you know, make a few jokes about that, you know, in terms of, you know, using soap and doing it for 20 seconds. And
20-second wash.
Yeah. Rabbi Wing with Temple Beth El in Rockford, thank you for being with us, and we wish you a joyous Passover.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And Father Jeff Grant with Blessed Sacrament Parish in Springfield, a little early, but happy Easter to you.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Easter to you then.
Before we go, we want to note the passing of John Prine. He's long been regarded among the best American songwriters, and Prine is a native of Illinois. Rolling Stone's Remembrance says he wrote many of his classics while working as a mailman in Maywood. John Prine died Tuesday at the age of 73, reportedly from complications related to COVID-19. And that is all the time we have for today's show. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music and John Prine for our outro music today. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.